I bring in this largemouth, and it's got tail feathers and feet sticking out his mouth.
Time for the Angler Within podcast with Roy Bilby.
Well, so I want to start our chit-chat talking about my grandson.
Okay, let's do it.
Hold on a second. I'll show you this. This was Summit Lake.
Oh, wow.
Look at that smile.
Is that a perch or a smallie in his hand?
That's a smallmouth.
It's the size of his arm.
Yeah, completely 100% on his own.
That's awesome. Was he using a squirm and shad?
He was using a Bass Pro Shops XPS grub, first cast. I go, you're casting like a pro. Yeah, I am. And then his rod loads up. And he's like, oh, I got one. I said, well, swing back on your rod. He pulls it back right over, lays it over his shoulder. And then he points it back towards the fish. I'm like, oh, good. You just gave him 4 foot of slack. He doesn't know that. I said, you got to keep reeling. And he catches up to it, and it's still hooked, which I couldn't believe. And he brings it right to the boat and completely 100% on his own. So we had a little moment in the boat there. And he stands up in the boat and announces to the world, okay, fishermen, pay attention. There's a new fisherman in charge. And he sits down. But there's nobody there. You know, he's just making a proclamation to the world. So look out, people.
I got to meet him once, obviously. He does seem to have quite the, I'll say that he's definitely has personality, but I would say he seems like he's very creative. Like he's
got a great imagination.
That's awesome. That's not saying his imagination is great. So to him,
when I was a kid,
I could see that.
I was aware of it.
You were, or you were not aware of it.
I was aware that I had a very good imagination as a child. I could be anywhere I wanted to be by just imagining it in my mind. And I realized as a young kid in grade school that I could do that. I could remove myself and just be anywhere I wanted to be in my mind. And it was just something I did a lot, just because maybe I was just in my own world, but I had a very open imagination, and I used it to my advantage when I needed to. And even as a kid, a young kid, I realized I was aware of that, and I enjoyed it. Mm-hmm. So not like I didn't know.
So what are we talking about today, sir?
The difference between cover and structure and how to use them or fish them to your advantage. So a lot to cover here.
Lots of cover in cover.
Yeah. Covering cover. There you go.
Today we're covering cover.
Covering cover and giving it structure.
Well, that's good. I was looking at the I was looking at structure today while I was out fishing. Once again, like I said, I was using a rowboat. And so, yep. You know, when you're out there with the rowboat and no troller holding you in place, and I didn't drop an anchor either. I was just kind of at the mercy of the wind. Yep. I was pushed into the structure.
Okay. Yeah, it'll do that.
And the cover.
Yeah.
But I was thinking about your comments last time about going for the shadow line.
Yeah.
On the shore. Yep. And, you know, my question for you is this. Even if there's shadow and it's shallow water, say, you know, a foot or, you know, 9 or 10 inches, do large fish still hold in those shallows close to the shore like that?
Yeah, they do.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, they do. That's what I found fishing for smallmouth, fishing shade lines against rocky shorelines. You're like, how many inches of water are there? And we're still pulling out keepers. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it absolutely 100%. I'll tell you, the last one we did, one thing I missed. I love that you do this, and somehow you always extract the perfect line for it. When you first turn on the podcast, it always starts with like, when the water temp hits 42 degrees, call me. Right? You didn't have any lead in line. I love that part.
Well, it depends. I can't do it every time because then they're going to expect it every time, you know?
But that's part of our trademark.
Okay. All right. So I'll make sure I add some more in. If the thing is, Roy, if nothing really jumps out at me also, I can't force those either.
Right.
So sometimes if you're in an impassioned moment, I'll grab it. You know?
Often happens,
you know, but
every episode up until that one, I'm like, that was the perfect line. You know, you've just haven't. If I was to pick a line, that's the one I would pick. I don't know how you do it. I had a couple
that episode. I had a few lines that you had done. Did you like the one about falling asleep standing up?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes, I did. Yes, I did. A perfect line.
Well, you know, and you're the perfect fisherman. So we're a good team.
I wanted to discuss, because there's a lot of confusion here, the difference between cover and structure. They get confused all the time, and both are an inherent part of the fishing that we all do, whether we realize it or not. And they often get confused. So cover includes things like lily pads, little dollar pads, grass beds, stumps, brush, docks. Those are tangible things, even intangible things like shade lines. And we'll get into that. Structure is different. Those are things that are a part of the topography of the bottom that are more or less, for lack of a better phrasing, permanently attached, like drop-offs, ledges, even stuff like boulders on the bottom, creek channels, submerged in impoundments, submerged roads beds, underwater, you know, submerged bridges, points, even flats, and like bridge pilings. So that's basically the difference between cover and structure. And I'll start with the structure. It's one of my favorite things to fish in the early days when I was dropping jigs for walleyes and stuff. I knew they liked the deeper water. Well, I know a lot more about them now, but all I knew then was that they kind of hung deep during the day. But it depends on the day. I've had days when you got a storm coming in and it gets overcast and the wind kicks up and you got a front coming in. I've caught walleye in 6 foot of water over top of grass beds running spinner baits of all things. And it's a consistent pattern. And 2 years later, In Fisherman put out an article about doing that exact same thing. And I'm like, oh, great. Tell everybody, you know, I've been doing that for 2 years. And that's happened several times over the years where I came up with something that I thought was a new technique. And then a year or two later, In Fisherman does a story about it. I'm like, man, they busted me again. But it was cool because I kind of showed me that I was on a leading edge of some of those techniques out there that weren't commonplace. But I used to use drop-offs to fish for the walleye, and I still use them all the time in my fishing. Drop-offs are a great structure. In the fall, smallmouth will move to the drop-offs because they'll use them to access wintering hole because it leads to deeper water. I mean, it seems like an obvious transition, and it is. It works like magic. If you know these things, like I said before, you can go out and look like a genius because you know where to go when and what to throw when you get there. But we had a lake, had shallow flats, but it had a drop-off that dropped right into 20 foot of water. And I used to go run a grub on a jig head down that drop-off, down that break line to that 20 foot bottom for walleye all the time. And it was consistently good. And if I wanted to catch them during the day, that's what I would do. They weren't always there, but when they were, man, they would play. And we caught a lot of other fish doing that. Most fish relate to drop-offs. It's easy access when they want to change the depth that they're using, either because water temperature changes or windy conditions or light conditions changing. They just use them all year long to gravitate either up or down to shallower or deeper water, and drop-offs hold fish. If you got rocky ledges, one of the creeks I fish has got a set of ledges in it, and it's kind of shaped like a V. There's a V notch in the middle of it. It's a great place to leave jigs behind. It eats jigs. It eats anything with a hook. And I'd like to snorkel that ledge sometime because there's a gold mine of tackle down there, and it ain't all just mine.
So this is probably a topic for a future episode, but how much effect does the wind have? Obviously, we see the effect it has on the surface of the water.
Right.
How much effect does the wind have underneath the water?
The bigger the body of water, like the Great Lakes, I mean, a lot of people wouldn't know this. The Great Lakes have current because it's wind generated, and the fish relate to that current. That just like in a river, they will position, the current positions them. You can tell which way they're facing, and you know which way to present a lure to them, so you're coming right into their face. You can use the wind to your advantage. The thing about the wind is most fishermen curse the wind, but it can be your best friend because it positions the bait and it positions the fish. If you learn to use the wind to your advantage, you'll be a lot better off. The whole thing for me as a tournament guy, and tournament fishermen will agree with this, the best thing you can do to improve as a tournament fisherman or any fisherman is learn to accept the things that you can't change or control and worry about the things that you can control. I can control the quality of the tackle I'm using, the freshness of the line, the freshness of my knot, the sharpness of my hooks, the angle and speed of my retrieve. I can control all of that. I cannot control the wind. Mm-hmm. I can't control the direction. I can't control the velocity. So that's something I have to accept. And what I do to accept that is I have learned to adapt to it and use it to my advantage. We had a tournament on Canandaigua Lake a few years back, my regular partner and I. It was a windy day. We had 15 to 20 mile an hour winds. It was pretty gusty. There were big rollers and white caps all day. It was not a great day to be out there. We won that tournament because I employed a drift sock and used the wind to our advantage. We were fishing cover on structure. The structure we were fishing was a drop-off, and it was covered with grass. And the grass, this drop-off, it was along a flat that's generally 5, 6, 7 foot deep. Once it hits 8 foot, it drops right down to 12, and then to 16, and then into the depths, 20, 24, 30. These fish were positioned on the outside edge of that grass bed. And the grass stopped at 14 foot. It was like a wall. And they were right on that outside edge. What we did is we backed off it, and I threw out a drift sock. If you don't know what that is, it's like a giant vinyl canvas funnel with a small hole on the small end and straps, and you just tie it to a boat cleat and run it out on a rope, and it collects all this water, but it lets it out very slow. It's like putting on brakes, water brakes. In all that wind, we had the wind at our back, and we were pitching black and blue skirted jigs with craw trailers to that base of that weed line, and we cleaned house on largemouth. Once we got past that break line and we were into, 10, 12 foot, weren't catching them anymore, pull into drift sock, start the outboard, make a wide arc and idle back out into about 24 foot of water, throw out that drift sock and use the trolling motor to go where we wanted and line us up till we could go down that brake line again. The wind was blowing us right into it, so we couldn't go parallel to it. We had no choice but to fish into it. But with the wind at our backs, we could pitch those jigs straight in front of us, both standing shoulder to shoulder on the front deck and just whacking them because we had no bow in our line because the wind was at our back. So we used the wind to our advantage via a drift sock, and we won that tournament easily. We had a 5-fish limit. We could have won with 4 fish. We really, we won by a wide margin. Watching other anglers the last 2 hours of that tournament, either they were drifting areas and going through them way too fast, or they were anchored and they were bouncing like a cork on a tether. And you'd see them, they were actually sitting down to fish because it was rough to stand when you're anchored, and they had their chin in their hand with their elbow on their knee, and they're holding the rod, and they'd already given up. They were just waiting for this thing to be over, and we're still loading the boat. We actually saw, with 30 minutes left in the day, two boats. We could see the road leading out of the ramp, and we saw two boats on trailers that were in the tournament. And I said to my partner, weren't those guys at the check-in this morning? He goes, yeah, I remember both of those boats. I said, well, we already beat them. They left. It was such a windy, rough day. People really struggled, except for us, because I employed a drift sock, used something that I could not control to our advantage, put on the brakes, and we kept the wind at our backs, which helped us feel what was going on with no loop or bow in our line. And we caught fish all day, big ones. And that was the only time I used a drift sock to win a tournament. But the wind played into our hands because we were able to utilize and adapt to something that we had no control over. So, yeah, the wind it does position the fish, and I think they were deep along that grass line because of all that wind. That's why they were hanging down and on the bottom in 14 foot, because things were rough up shallow. So they weren't feeding on the flat. It was pretty, a lot of turmoil going on up there. And the other people that fished that tournament, you could tell by watching the way they were fishing. They'd already quit. They were just waiting for this thing to end. And we were like, hey, that gives us more time to catch them. And we did. So I'd like the opportunity to do that again, because I know exactly how I would approach it. And hopefully the fish would comply again. But it worked in our favor that day. So and again, we were fishing a drop off, but it had grass beds that stopped right at 14 foot. So we utilized cover that was positioned on structure. So another form, we were talking about ledges. They hold fish. Again, it's a way to go from shallow to deep water without covering a lot of ground. They just move vertically, and ledges hold fish. A lot of the lakes I fish for smallmouth and the rivers, they have ledges. And if you can locate those different times of the year, they are fish magnets. The ledges in the rivers I fish are good late spring, right through fall. In the fall, they stack up against those walls. If you've ever been to a Bass Pro Shops or Cabela's and look at the fish in their tanks, if they've got a rock wall in a bank simulating a ledge, many days you'll see fish stacked like train cars along those rock ledges. This is what fish do in their natural environment. And all you got to do is make some casts and poke around with electronics and look and to locate these structures and fish them and find out if they're there on that particular day. Boulders. Anybody that fishes lakes with boulders, especially for smallmouth, use something that looks like a crawdad, use something that looks like a minnow, bang it into the boulders, get their attention. Boulders are a piece of structure that holds fish. I would consider them more structure than cover, because they're permanently attached to the body. Ain't nobody moving them. If it gets windy enough to move boulders, I'm heading for the ramp with all the other smart people. Boulders are great. I love fishing them, but they're tricky to fish. You'll eat a lot of jigs. Another way to approach them, much safer and much more cost effective, is a crankbait. And here's a little trick. People, I don't know if they're aware, most guys are, crawfish elicit a little clicking sound. And that's why a lot of the rattling baits that we talked about last episode, they're good for smallmouth, because they replicate that clicking sound. But if you take a crankbait that dives, say you got boulders on a flat in like 12 foot of water, find a crankbait that dives to 14, use fluorocarbon line, like 10 pound test, fluorocarbon sinks, that'll help that bait dive to its maximum depth. If you got boulders in 10, 12 feet and you're using a 14 foot diving crankbait, you're going to bang into those rocks and it's going to make a clack. Use a crawfish colored bait and just throw it and bang into those rocks. Contact that structure, hit those boulders. It's not going to snag. It's got a diving bill that's going to deflect it off that, and the hooks won't even touch the rock. But boy, you'd be surprised how many times once you make contact, you feel it bump that boulder, you stop for a second, it's going to start to float up, and you'll get slammed. It's the coolest thing in the world, fishing a crankbait like that, banging it into stuff. And boulders are definitely structure that you can do that with. Now, we don't have a lot of impoundments up here in upstate New York. Down in the South, they're very common. They always built dams to generate electricity. The Tennessee Valley Authority built countless dams, and they're operated by the Army Corps of Engineers, and they created lakes like Gunnersville and all those lakes in the Mid-South and in the Midwest where they have these huge impoundments, and these lakes have current, and it's not wind generated. It's they're impounded rivers. So there's creek channels in these. Creek channels are a tremendous form of structure. I'm fortunate that within probably a 40-minute drive of my house, there are two impoundments. One is there's the Gilboa Dam, the Blenheim Spillway. There's a reservoir there that they use to create electricity, and it's it's a dam on the Schoharie Creek. And yeah, there's a creek channel there. This thing is loaded with walleye and smallmouth. Creek channels still have inside and outside bends. They're still current. It's structure that fish use. They'll use a creek channel as a travel corridor, believe it or not. If you have impounded roadbeds, they'll follow those as travel corridors. The Great Sacandaga Reservoir, it's a reservoir, but they flooded a village decades ago, and there's a whole village down there. There's roads, there's bridges, there's buildings that are on the bottom there. You can, if you've got a contour map of that lake, it'll show those old road beds, and you can go out on that lake. We've done this. You can, even with the old rudimentary electronics we had, with the electronics we have nowadays, it's crazy. You can go out and you can find this stuff and you can fish it. It's crazy. Great stuff to run a drop shot on, or run like a football head jig or something like that. Something that goes down and bangs on the bottom. It's a neat kind of fishing that is pretty rare up here. It's very common in the South, but up here, there's only a few places we can do it. But I know all three of them. Goodyear Lake is another one where it's the headwaters of the Susquehanna River that runs from New York down through Pennsylvania and beyond. And there's a creek channel there. And there's a wind. That's when I think about fishing ledges and drop-offs. I do that on that lake in November. We had days when we've caught 82, 85, 88 smallmouth. It's insane. Everybody's bow hunting and I'm swinging in one brown fish after another. And I got the lake all to myself. It's like, you talk about heaven on earth, boy. I get to live it. And I share that with some people. One of the people I share that with is my primary physician, Dr. Greg Riss. He's a great dear friend. Here's the guy. I love to fish with Greg because he analyzes things the same way I do. He breaks down, he draws information from every fish. That one hit it on the drop. So we got to start doing this. And we work so well together as a team. He's just one of my favorite people to fish with when I'm fun fishing. And we always connect in November just before deer season opens to go to Goodyear and just hammer down on those smallmouth. And I've shown that to people and they're like, I can't believe I've never caught this many fish in one day. And they're bass, for crying out loud. I'm like, we do this every year. Again, if you know where to go and what to throw and when to do it seasonally, you can look like a genius. And it's so easy to do because I've spent decades studying it like my life depended on it when it didn't. But that it's a passion I can't ignore. I'm fortunate my wife allows me to pursue that and she supports it. And I'm very, very blessed in that regard. That covers creek channels. How about submerged roadbeds? We started on that just a little bit. Places like Great Sacandaga Reservoir. There's roads down there that they used to use when it was a village. And the same thing with the Blenheim Gilboa Dam.
Blenheim Dam, yeah. There's a town in there too.
Yes, there is. When the water is drawn down, I've seen the tip of the church steeple out there.
That's but crazy.
The problem with that is you can't run a bass boat on it. You can only run a rowboat on it. No motors allowed, not even electric, because it's a reservoir for the New York City water system.
Right. Also, Cannonsville, I think, same deal, right?
The reservoir over there has got a part of that reservoir system. I think
there's a town in that one.
Seven or eight reservoirs in that system.
What's that?
There's seven or eight reservoirs in that system.
Yeah, there's a bunch. Yeah, but in Cannonsville, there's also, like what I'm asking though, there is a town underwater there too, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's a place to go with portable electronics because you have to use a rowboat. Oh, and there's a catch. You have to leave it there. You can only use it on that reservoir. You can't take it anyplace else because that's a good way to keep invasive species out, and it works. So you have to have a boat. You have to get a permit to fish the reservoir. It's good for all of them. It used to be you had to renew it every 3 years. It used to be free. I doubt if it is anymore. That was decades ago. And I just don't fish those because ain't no way I'm leaving one of my boats someplace and only using it one place.
So
I use them everywhere.
So the people who are locking their boats to the trees out there, are they paying to lock their boat there too? Is that what that permit is for essentially? Or is that like,
no, their permits. So if you get checked, you have to have permission to fish the reservoirs. They want to know who's there.
That whole shore is fair game to lock your boat up to use on that lake.
Yes, it is.
Because I see them out there a lot.
And they know that, and they let people do that because by doing that, they know that they have one boat that they only use there.
So that's why you go on the marketplace, you buy yourself a 10-foot John boat for $200, and you lock it to a tree.
You caulk the crap out of it so it doesn't sink, and you chain it to a tree well away from the shoreline.
Yep.
And then you spend $2,000 on Garmin LiveScope Portable, and you go out and you find those buildings and you fish them. $200 for a boat, $2,000 for electronics. And I guarantee you there's people that do that, and I bet they catch them. I've heard stories of huge fish in those reservoirs.
The lake trout are gigantic out there, too. And the brown trout.
And the walleye. And the smallmouth. I got to hook up with somebody that keeps a boat down there. Any listeners out there got a boat chained to a tree on one of those New York City reservoirs that wants to take me fishing? I will reciprocate with a trip in my Nitro. Lake of your choice. How's that for an offer?
There. I'm waiting for my ride in that Nitro.
Yeah. Yeah, we'll do that. We'll do that. Put a boat on a reservoir, JD. Cost you $200. We'll use my live scope and my Nitro when we go out, and everything's fair game. Points and flats. Points, fish will travel up points and use them as a travel corridor, go from deep to shallow. Points always head out into deeper water. And most lakes have them, a ton of reservoirs and impoundments have them, because they're fed by all those creeks, and every creek channel that runs in to a reservoir or a lake has a point on the up current and down current side. There's 2 points, and inside them there's secondary points, and it just, points are a great fish holding piece of structure. Throw a top water across them in the morning, late in the day, in the evening. Run buzzabaits across them when there's a light chop on the surface. Later in the day, as the sun's getting higher, start running jigs down the drop off on the tips of the points. The options that points offer us are limitless. And a lot of times they'll have some cover on them, shallow, like grass beds or lily pads or pea gravel. Anything like that. A lot of fish spawn on points. Pea gravel points are famous for having smallmouth spawn on them, and bluegill. Points are just crazy good places to fish. When I go to a lake that I'm unfamiliar with, one of the first thing I look for is points, because they're fish holding structure. And again, it's a tangible part of the bottom and shoreline topography that is structure, not cover. It's permanently attached. But when we talk about flats, I have said this for years. Shallow fish are feeding fish. They're active fish. When I fish tournaments on rivers, generally, first thing in the morning, I will head straight for the flats. And we'll run, depending on the time of year, we'll run top waters, we'll run swim jigs, we'll run swim baits. If we're not getting bit that way, we'll drag the bottom with jigs. My point here is, if fish are on flats, they're going to be active. They don't go there to rest. They go there to feed. Flats are the banquet table for fish in rivers. And shallow fish are active feeding fish. So if you're fishing a flat, your odds go up for catching fish. That's always been my theory, and it's never proved me wrong. We catch a lot of our fish in the rivers on flats because they're active and feeding. Now, there's other times you've got to go to the lock on a river and fish the spillway, because that generates oxygen and it creates plunge pools. It creates current. It creates current seams. And those are great things to fish, because fish use those to feed in. When bait comes washing down those current seams, the fish are there waiting. And if you can figure out where those are by reading the surface, a lot of times it's obvious if you know what to look for. And you can run a bait and make the, you know, get your angles right, and you can get bit on every cast. We had a tournament, and I shouldn't be putting this out there because I know some of the guys I compete against listen to this podcast. Let's just say we had a tournament on a particular river, and we're fishing a particular lock on this river. I like the corners of the locks because there's 2 angles there. And I was taking a swim jig, and I was banging it off the corner because it would get sucked right down into that plunge pool. And I could feel the pull of the current on my bait. As soon as I felt that current release, I got slammed. The fish were sitting right in that slack current. And as the bait fish got washed out of that plunge pool right to the point where it went slack, those fish were shooting out and nailing them, because the fish in that slack water didn't have to fight that heavy current, and the bait fish were just tumbling around. And when they came through it, the fish were right there, easy pickings. By ricocheting my jig off that corner, it hit the sweet spot every time, got pulled down into that plunge pool, and when I felt that current release, I got a bone-jarring strike every time. Cast after cast after cast. My partner couldn't believe it. He's like, I guess I'll just keep the net in my hand, you know? And it was, yeah, it was one of those rare days where I outfished my partner. He was tough to beat. I once told him, I said, man, I am so glad you are my partner because I would not want to fish against you. And he turned to me, smiled. He said, I wouldn't want to fish against you either. And that's what made us good partners. And that's why we did so well together. But we also knew the importance of fishing flats in the rivers and all the points of structure that I've discussed here. Now, if you want to talk cover, and covers can exist on structure. But again, cover is things like lily pads, grass beds, stumps, brush, even docks, and in particular, shade lines. And I'll talk about it at the end. But so let's hit lily pads first. I told the story about how I got involved using Berkley power baits, how I was introduced to that, where the guy I was fishing, we were fishing this huge, massive lily pad field. And he was using a power worm and I was using a plastic, regular plastic worm. Every fish I hooked was getting wound up into pads and breaking off. And he was landing every fish because he was using that power bait, which they were holding. And he would just gently reel till he got the fish led all the way out of the lily pads. And then he'd set the hook. But that illustrates, I mean, I use that example to illustrate how effective power bait was. Now I'm using it to illustrate how effective fishing lily pads is. Fish use them for cover. They create shade. In the heat of the summer, pad fields are great because the temperature of the water beneath those pads is cooler because of the shade that the pads offer. And fish will utilize that shade. Plus, it creates a dark area. Here's the thing about cover, like a dock or lily pads that create that shade. Again, I've talked about people giving human characteristics to fish that they assumed years ago, actually books were written that stated that bass will use docks and lily pads as shade to protect their eyes because the sunlight hurts their eyes because they don't have eyelids.
I figured it was more because they didn't get picked off by a predator.
Well, we're talking about predators here. Predators like largemouth and pike and walleye.
I mean like from above, like birds.
Oh yeah.
Like, you know, birds of prey.
I got you.
Yeah.
Here's the thing. My God doesn't make any mistakes. He built fish without lids, eyelids, because fish don't need eyelids. Humans need eyelids. We live in a dry environment that's dusty, windy. There's debris in the air. We need eyelids to protect our eyes from the sand and grit and debris when the wind blows and the dust and all that stuff. Fish live in a liquid environment, an aquatic environment. There's no dust. They don't have eyelids because they don't need them. They don't need eyelids. The sun doesn't hurt their eyes. It doesn't. They're built. If they needed eyelids, they would have them. They don't have them because they don't need them. It's that simple. So why do they utilize the shade of docks and lily pads? One thing, it's cooler under there in the heat of the summer, but they use that shade to their advantage because they are a predator and they can see better into a well-lit area from a dark area. Case in point. And I'm not giving them human characteristics there. I'm just using an example that humans can relate to. Say you've got a house on Main Street and it's high noon. You've got a high pressure system, not a cloud in sight, bluebird skies, bright sunny day, and they've got every light on in that house. And you drive by on the main drag on Main Street and you look at that house sitting back off the road. All you see is that house. It's all you see. You can't see a thing that's going on in that house,
right?
Because it's too bright. You're looking into a well-lit area from an extremely well-lit area. Say you're doing that at high noon, brightest point of the day, all right? Spin the clock ahead 12 hours. Let's throw in some moon phase here. Let's say it's the new moon phase. You've got a black, black night. You're driving down Main Street. They still have every house in that light on. Well, now when you drive by, it's like you can see everything that's going on in that house because you're looking into a well-lit area from a completely dark area. That is why fish utilize docks and lily pads for shade. It's not because they don't have eyelids and the sun hurts their eyes. It's because they are a predator and they can see into a well-lit area from a dark area. It's an advantage for them. And they know that and they use that. They know that instinctively. They've experienced that and they use it to their advantage. That's probably another reason why those fish, even though they're at the base of that grass line in that tournament we fished, why they were on the outside edge. They're looking into an area that's better lit from their vantage point, even down there at 14 foot, because they can see. They can see. I don't care how deep it is, fish can see. So that's an advantage of the shade that lily pads afford and docks as well. But docks also have, they have legs that support them. They have cross members. They have supports. There's docks create a whole underwater structure in addition to the overhead shade that they provide. And wooden docks are the best. Anybody out there who's a dock fisher like I am, and I'm not talking fishing from a dock. I'm fishing at a dock from my boat outside of the dock on this body of water. Those cross members of the wooden docks and the support posts, they over time, they get algae on them, which attracts little invertebrates, which attract bait fish, which attract game fish, which you're talking the food chain here. And it's a whole ecosystem down there. They not only provide shade, but they provide structure in the form of, and this is a combination of structure and cover, those dock posts can actually be structure while the dock itself providing shade is cover. So it's a twofer, you know. Mm-hmm. That's a bonus piece of cover slash structure, one of the few that exist. And bass in particular, largemouth, smallmouth, they like to relate to an object or objects. And a lot of times that is the support post or the cross member of these docks. Even if you got the docks that you roll into these reservoirs with the wheels, those wheels can hold fish. It's crazy. I've caught fish. Yeah. I've not seen them in them, but I've had them relate to them where I caught them right off the wheels. Not kidding.
And on your electronics, you can see the actual circular wheel with the hole. You can see
on it. The electronics I have now, I can.
Yeah. Yep. Interesting.
Undeniable. Look at that. Look at that wheel. Oh, look at that blob. There's a fish right there. Let's see if he'll strike.
What if there was a body?
Call the police.
I mean, can you see a body with it?
You could. Depends on how long it's been there and how silted in it is.
Oh, boy.
But if there was a body, you could absolutely see the form of it. You could. Oh. The electronics we have now, there's so much detail. It's stuff we only dreamed of decades ago. And I'm not kidding. We have it now. It's just like, I mean, you can FaceTime somebody on a cell phone. We saw that on the Jetsons when we were children.
Right.
Right? Now we hold it in our hand. I mean, the Jetsons were behind the times. It was on the wall, okay? We hold it in our hand, man. We hold it in our hand.
I always wanted a Rosie in the house.
Yeah.
The maid.
Well, they have the robotic vacuums. Buy one and name it Rosie.
Didn't she eat wrenches? Yeah, didn't Rosie, didn't you used to throw, like, tools at Rosie and she would eat them?
I think so.
I'll have to double check that. So what else is going on with the cover? Structure.
All right. So grass beds, one of my all-time favorites. We talked last episode about running rabble traps over the grass beds and, you know, ticking the grass and snapping it free. But grass beds in particular, one of my absolute favorite pieces of cover to fish with a Texas rig, lizard, or plastic worm. Hands down, my favorite place to throw one. Largemouth use grass bed. Oh, smallmouth do too. And we've caught walleye, pike, pickerel, everything doing this. But a Texas rig, which is a sliding bullet weight on your line, you tie in your worm hook, you rig your worm or your lizard, your soft plastic, whatever you're throwing, rig it weedless with a hook buried inside it and the point just skin hooked on the outside, you can throw that through any grass and it'll slither right through it. It's one of the few things that you can fish in grass. It's completely weedless, and when you feel that strike, you swing and that hook pops free and hooks them. Grass beds are one of my favorite deals to fish for largemouth and largemouth tournaments. Always looking for grass beds. And you hardly ever fish one where it's not productive. They almost always produce. Grass beds are phenomenal. I'm a grass bed fisherman. When I go to a lake I'm unfamiliar with, two of the first things I look for, points and grass beds. Not kidding. That's their guaranteed fish more often than not. Not always, but it's the closest thing I got to a guarantee. When I went to your lake, hadn't fished it in years. What did we fish right off the bat? Where'd you catch your first fish? Grass bed. Mm-hmm. That's where you caught it. I went, huh, guess I got to be throwing a Senko. And
purple and black.
Yeah, that's why I put one on. Stumps. Oh, man. I've got a lake that I fish. It's only got a few stumps left, but they're the best kind because you can see them just under the surface. They're easy to locate. I know where everyone is, and I'll take either a Texas rig or I'll take a black and blue skirted jig and a trailer, and I'll bump that stump and crawl it right over it. Oh, man, the strikes I get. Largemouth use stumps.
How productive is the stump lot over at Goodyear?
I have not fished that very much. Reason being, it's called Stump Patch for good reason. There's a gazillion stumps in there, and it's hard to run a bass boat back in there without banging into them.
Mm-hmm.
It's a good way to damage a prop. I won't run back in there. I'll approach it gingerly, keeping my trolling motor as high as possible. And the times I have fished it, it's been good. But I went in with a bass boat one time years ago. We were actually not fishing for bass. We were fishing for bluegill. And we caught a 108, I believe. It was insane. They weren't on the stumps, full disclosure. They were on a flat, and they were bedding, and it was magic time. I mean, palm-sized bluegills you couldn't hardly get your hand around, the kind that you fillet steaks off of. But I should go in there and fish that stump patch, but the water's only 2 foot, 2 or 3 foot deep. But that doesn't matter. There are certain times of the year I'd love to go in there and just bang a spinnerbait around that stuff. I'm sure I'd catch them. Probably a good way to catch largemouth on that lake. Matter of fact, in the fall, there's a club that has tournaments there. I'd be interested in going and checking that out for that tournament. You just gave me an idea. I got to write that down.
No. Oh, well, good.
Something I've probably been overlooking too long. Stumps are favorite for me on the lakes I fish that have them. It's, they seldom fail to produce. Brush is another one, and a lot of the brush I fish is on the banks, but in periods of high water, these bushes are in the water, and good grief. One of my favorite places to throw a skirted jig and trailer. Again, I talk about that bait a lot, but that's my big fish bait, and I always throw it around docks, around brush, and around stumps, which is the stuff we happen to be talking about right now. Brush is phenomenal. It holds a lot of fish. And again, if it's been in the water, it's got algae on it, which starts that whole chain reaction food chain deal. And there's predators there to take advantage of that food source. And you pitch a jig in there and it gets their attention. Brush lines are one of my favorite things to fish. In good grief, 7 or 8 of the lakes that I fish routinely, they have a bank that's all brush. And in my journal, I just refer to it as the brush bank, and I know exactly where I'm talking about. And I'll either throw spinnerbaits in tight when the water's high, I'll throw a spinnerbait into gaps because the bushes are in the water. And that's another time when you have high water in the spring or after heavy rains where it comes up and those bushes are now in the water, you can throw a spinnerbait in inches of water where it hasn't been before and the fish are there. They're scary shallow, real scary shallow. Got a good story about a particular largemouth that stands out. One morning I was fishing bushes on a lake not far from my house. The whole north side of this lake, 80% of it is covered with bushes, half in, half out of the water. And I was fishing there one day, throwing my skirted jig, and I was trying to make my cast so it just skimmed the branches where they contact the water so it would drop right there, right on that transition from water to brush. And I dropped the jig in there. I was catching a bunch of fish doing it. I get this strike. I bring in this largemouth, and it's got tail feathers and feet sticking out his mouth. And he hit my jig. So I'm like, oh, I want to see what kind of bird this is, you know? So I hold the bass by the lower lip, the traditional hold, and I grab the tail feathers, and I could reach the feet and pinched them in my thumb. And I just slowly started putting pressure, and I could feel his throat muscles contracting. And inch by inch, I backed that bird. It was a robin.
A baby or like a full, like an adult robin?
Yes.
An adult robin.
An adult robin, this bass ate.
How?
Now, here's what I think happened. This is, I'll never forget this fish. I'm coming up on 36,000 bass caught and released. As of today, I'm 170 by exact count shy of 36,000. So I'm coming up on another milestone. And I believe sometime towards the end of the month of May, I'll eclipse that 36,000. And there's certain fish in all those thousands of bass that stand out. This was one of them. Here's what I think happened. Because I was throwing my jig right where those branches touched the water at that transition line, I think that robin landed in that bush and worked his way down to the edge so he could get a drink of water. And the last thing he saw was the white inside of that bass's mouth.
You think he just came right out of the water and took him?
Absolutely. How is he going to catch a robin?
That's what I'm saying. I think
that
I have no
robin
idea.
Was on that branch where it touches the water, and robins have to have water. I think he was getting water, and the last thing he saw was that big mouth.
So that bass was actually, he was actually stalking that robin to begin with.
I have no idea. I think they were laying there because they're used to having things come out of those bushes and fall in the water or land in those bushes that they perceive as prey. They eat dragonflies. Dragonflies, they absolutely spot. And I've seen bass come out of the water and catch a dragonfly in the air. I've seen them do it. You're not going to believe this.
Mayflies,
it's only
too.
Happened a few times. But there was a day when they were biting dragonflies like crazy. They kept flipping out of the water twice that day. I'm throwing a 1/8 ounce Flex spinnerbait, and twice before it hit the water, a bass came out of the water. I watched my cast. He came out of the water and caught that spinnerbait in the air before it hit the water. And I hooked him and I caught him twice in one day.
Not bad.
So I think that bass had very recently caught that robin. And when I pitched my jig in there, he just figured something else came off that bush and he grabbed it. And He weighed a quarter pound. He was a quarter pound lighter when I released him. But he had swallowed a robin. We've caught smallmouth in creeks that have swallowed mice, voles. Twice we've caught fish that had a bat in their mouth. Now, you know, they caught that in the air and it was at night. So yeah, they're looking up at night too. Crazy. I talked about brush, docks, stumps. Oh. The one thing I haven't talked about yet is shade lines, and I really want to cover that because I think it's overlooked by a lot of fishermen. I have a lake that I fish. It's got a lot of islands, and there's one island that runs north to south. Most of them run east-west. This one runs north-south. So in the morning when the sun's rising, there's a long shade line on the west side of this island. About 9:30, 10 o'clock in the morning is when I head over there because now the shade line's about 5-6 feet. So it comes out into where the water's got decent depth to it. It's a pretty good drop off on this one that's west side of this island. Bass will use that shade line. I've gotten there just to illustrate how bass utilize a shade line for cover. Because again, it's a little bit darker and they can see into that well-lit area, and it helps camouflage them because the water's shaded and darker there. And they absolutely utilize that as a predator. I've gotten there like 11:30 when that shade line is diminishing because that sun's getting pretty high. And now that shade line is like only 12 to 18 inches off that bank where the water's a foot or less deep. And if you land in that shade line, you're getting bit. And if you land outside of that shade, you're not. I had a young fellow with me who was just learning to fish, and I took him there and I said, have you ever fished a shade line? Well, what's that? So I showed him, and it was late in the day. It was one of those days when there was just a sliver of shade along that shoreline. It had to be 12 inches of water or less. And he said, you really think you're going to catch a fish out of that? I caught 6 fish out of that shade line, more than a limit. He couldn't believe that. We're making casts, and he said, I mean, when we got done that day, he said, I can't believe what I learned. He said, when you told me that, I'll be honest, I thought you were pulling my leg. I thought no fish is going to be in a little strip of shade that narrow. He said, but if we landed outside of that shade line, he said, which a lot of my casts did, I didn't get bit. But if you landed in the shade, you got bit. It was crazy. I said, yeah. And my casts that fell short where I didn't land it, I wasn't. They were in that shade to ambush while it lasted. And then they're going to disperse and head deep. So, I mean, that's the differences between structure and cover. And in the case of like a dock, they can be combined, or on a drop off with grass, they can be combined. But that's how I utilize structure and cover, or in some cases cover on structure, because it absolutely positions fish. They use it to ambush their prey. And if you know that and can figure out when they're there, you can absolutely use it to your advantage. And the whole point of this podcast, as we said, is to pass on some of the knowledge that I have acquired in 40 years of dedicated chronicling my trips and writing everything down in with a tremendous amount of detail. And that's how I can talk about this stuff. Like I don't run out of, like my third lung kicks in because I just get on a roll talking about this stuff because I've been studying it for 40 years and continue to study it and write it down because there's always more to learn. Always more to learn.
So that does it for our talk on structure and cover today. We covered cover and structure.
We covered cover and we gave structure to structure.
So if you have any questions for Roy, hit us up, send us an email, anglerwithinpodcast@gmail.com. And as always, hit up Roy's Instagram page, all lowercase Roy Bilby. And thank you for listening. We appreciate it more than you realize. And it would be super nice if you could go ahead and hit that that rating button. If you're on Spotify, give us a rating. 5-star would be great. We've gotten 6 5-star reviews. So
awesome.
Yeah. Other podcasts that have way more episodes than we do, because we're just a baby by comparison, they don't have 5 stars. So we're doing all right so far. If you have a moment, give us a review. 5 stars.
Yeah, that'd be wonderful. We appreciate you taking the time out of your day. Just trying to pass on the knowledge that I've acquired over the years to help you tap into your Angler Within.